This particular archaeological find has been on again and off again. It made quite a bit of news when it first broke into the news. The ossuary, the James ossuary, a bone box from, undisputably, from the first century A.D., and with an inscription that has been disputed and is still being disputed. The inscription reading, James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. We read all about it in the paper. Now it is the subject of the cover story of the latest Christianity Today, titled Biblical Archaeology's Dusty Little Secret. We're going to spend a few minutes talking about that a little later in this hour. Dr. David Menton joins us first to talk about another discovery, that being a jawbone. We're always finding these bones, these human remains, and archaeologists and anthropologists tell us a million years, 100,000 years, dates like these. They tell us that there were several strains of human beings as human beings were evolving. Some of them were dead ends, we're told, like Neanderthal. Well, there apparently is a new discovery that gives lie to that particular presupposition about the origins of human life. We'll be talking about that with Dr. David Menton in the first half hour of Issues Etc. today. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In the second hour, Bob Leko joins us. You may have read about this in the paper. Kenneth Hagin, who was hospitalized last week, died on Friday. The announcement was made today. Kenneth Hagin Sr., of course, the granddaddy of the Word Faith movement. We'll talk with Bob Leko, former Word Faith pastor, about the significance of this event. Then, later on in the second hour, Amy White joins us to talk about a recent column that she has written for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on judicial activism called Judicial Branch Exceeds Its Power. Let's see. Oh, we've got more even than that. Paul Copan joins us in the third hour of the program. For the first half hour, we're going to talk a bit about the religious discrimination that people will find on the college and university campus and what can be done about it. Why is there religious discrimination? Why are all points of view equal on today's tolerant college campuses except for the religious point of view? And then, even then, only some religions. In the last half hour of the program, open lines for your questions and your comments. Forbes magazine has an interesting and short article titled Mega Churches, Mega Businesses. I'll just let you dwell upon that before we get to that last half hour of Issues Etc. open lines today. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Before we get started with Dr. Menton, I need to mention an event that's going to be held this Saturday at 10 o'clock. It is a private screening of the forthcoming Luther movie. It's for KFUO listeners only. It's this Saturday, September the 27th at 10 o'clock at the DePere Cinema. That's the DePere 14 Cinema at 270 and Manchester Road. It's a private screening for AM 850 KFUO listeners. I will be there leading a discussion before the screening and after the screening. There will be a drawing for prizes. The cost is $10 per person, which includes your ticket, a soda, and popcorn. So you have all the amenities of the movie-going experience and a discussion of the Luther movie afterwards. If you'd like to order tickets, have your MasterCard, your Visa, or your Discover card ready and call now before the end of the regular business day, 1-800-844-0524, 1-800-844-0524, or if you call locally, 725-3030, 725-3030, have your Visa, MasterCard, or Discover card ready. It's $10 per person this Saturday, 10 o'clock in the morning, a private screening for AM 850 KFUO listeners of the Luther movie at the DePere 14 Cinema. Dr. David Menton is Associate Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University. He is a speaker for Answers in Genesis, and he's president of the Missouri Association for Creation. He'll be joining us here in just a moment. You've seen the story, perhaps, in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Bone Find Sheds Light on Early Habits. Apparently, it sheds light on more than just early habits. There's a question as to whether or not what evolutionists have often called the evolutionary dead end in human development, Neanderthals, had anything to do, interbreeded, or could even interbreed with the line of human beings that are supposed to have given rise to us. We are told we're not descendants from Neanderthal. They were an evolutionary dead end. They didn't, or perhaps even couldn't, interbreed with modern human beings. But apparently there is some evidence by way of fossilized bones that that is not the case. We'll find out about that in just a moment. While we're waiting to get Dr. Menton, let me give you a bit of a preview of this article from Forbes magazine. It's under the heading Christian Capitalism, Mega Churches, Mega Businesses. Now, what it does is outline not the incomes or the revenues of these huge churches here in the United States, but what it does is talk about the techniques being used by these large churches. And their techniques have to do, well, at least according to Forbes, more with business than with church. What I find interesting here, and then we'll get to a little bit more of this a little later in the program, what I find interesting is the top five churches in the United States are, in fact, not the ones we're always talking about, Willow Creek and Saddleback. They actually fall into the middle of the pack. The top five mega churches, mega businesses, as they're called in Forbes magazine, are, in fact, ones that you only hear about if you watch Trinity Broadcasting Network, like the Church of Joel Osteen or Creflo Dollar or T.D. Jakes. More on that later. Gordon Govier is news director for WNWC Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. He's executive producer of a weekly radio show called The Book and the Spade, and he's author of the cover story of the latest issue of Christianity Today magazine. It's titled Biblical Archaeology's Dusty Little Secret. Gordon, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Todd, it's good to be with you.
Can you take us through the somewhat convoluted and yet short history of this artifact, this James ossuary?
Well, this thing surfaced almost exactly 1 year ago. I got my first contact from Christianity Today. They'd been contacted about it, and they wanted me to write a story on it. And shortly thereafter, I was contacted by the Biblical Archaeology Society in Washington, who was coordinating a news conference on this. And the announcement basically was that they had an artifact that had somehow come into existence or knowledge that may provide people a touching point to Jesus Christ, and it hasn't really added a lot to our knowledge of biblical characters. But what it has done is give us another place to identify with the Bible. And that's basically one of the reasons that people go to the Holy Land in the first place, is to make that physical connection. So in essence, what it is a stone box. It's about 18 inches long, and it was used very commonly in the first century to put the bones of the deceased after all the flesh had desiccated away, and then they would store it in the tomb. And this particular box had the inscription, James, the son of Joseph, brother of Jesus, in Aramaic, and it looked to be very authentic. And in fact, they had done some work that seemed to authenticate it. But since that announcement in October of 2002, there has been a growing controversy over its authenticity. And that's not uncommon either for an artifact that purports to be as important as this one. You certainly want to make sure, that, if at all possible, that it is authentic, and if it's not, to disprove it. So there's been an ongoing debate, and it continues. But what happened in June was a very interesting thing. The Israel Antiquities Authority in Jerusalem held a news conference and announced that after their very careful analysis of several months, they had decided that the inscription was a forgery. It probably is 2,000 years old and an authentic ossuary of the period, but they felt that someone had somehow fake this inscription to make it look very authentic, and so it was fooling people, and they pronounced it a fraud.
It wasn't just fooling, you know, the average Joe like me. It was fooling people who have devoted their entire life's scholarly work to studying inscriptions like this, people who have made it their life's work and really the basis of their stellar reputations, like Herschel Shanks, of making sure that artifacts are genuine before going public with them, didn't it?
Well, Herschel Shanks is an attorney by training. He's not an archaeologist, and neither am I. I'm a journalist. But there are people who are experts in inscriptions that, in fact, André Lemaire, probably one of the leading world experts at the Sorbonne in Paris, still maintains that it is an authentic inscription. And there are some others that also still feel the same way. So the debate continues.
So here are the possibilities. We've got a very old bone box that may at one time have been blank. And someone in the modern day and age scratched an inscription upon it using very sophisticated techniques to make it appear not only to the eye but to all of the batteries of scientific tests to appear to be an authentic first century inscription. Or I guess it could also be an ancient hoax, or it could be genuine. Are those the possibilities here?
Yeah, I think so. Well, yeah. It could be that the inscription really is 2,000 years old, but it does not refer to Jesus of Nazareth in terms of being James, the brother of Jesus. You know, it could be another Jesus, and that was one of the possibilities that the experts looked into in terms of just the odds. What are the odds of a family that has those three characters living in Jerusalem in the first century, and they calculated that, and there's been some recalculations, and so it really is impossible to prove that it is really James, the brother of Jesus Christ. I think it would be almost impossible to absolutely prove that that is true.
Now, this little controversy that we've been witnessing for the last year says as much about the state of archaeology as it does about the politics of archaeology. Tell us how these two are interwoven with one another.
Well, that was really the thrust of the article, and that's what the editors at Christianity Today wanted me to address, is the political nature of archaeology, because archaeology is not just digging in the dirt and pulling something out and saying it looks like. You know, that's how archaeology was done 200 years ago. And there are still people out there that that do archaeology that way, and they don't have much validity, but they do have their own little devoted following of people, and they speak in churches and get people excited about archaeology, but what they're talking about really isn't authentic archaeology. It's adventurism, I guess you'd say, or faux archaeology. But that's just one dimension of it. In essence, in order to have archaeology, it is a political process. If you make a discovery of something, you need to, first of all, excavate it very carefully, because in excavating, you're destroying the evidence. As you dig down, you're destroying all of the corroborating evidence that indicates what kind of a culture it's coming from, or what level in the dirt, or whatever. So you need to keep careful records. And then you put those records together and you publish it as a scientist in a peer-reviewed publication, and the other scientists who are just as experienced as you are look at it and evaluate it, and a consensus develops on whether or not you actually have an authentic discovery. That's how the scientific process works. It's political in a way, and that really is what you need in order to have an authentic scientific discovery. And the problem with the James ossuary right now is that the scientific evidence that was accumulated by the Israel Antiquities Authority as they made their study has not been released. They've released summaries, but they haven't released all the details. And so there are other people like Professor Ben Witherington at Asbury Seminary in Kentucky, who says, you know, let's have some more scientists look at it. Let's have an independent group look at it and evaluate it, because he still believes it's authentic.
We're talking about the James Bonebox controversy. Gordon Govier is our guest. He is author of the cover story in the latest issue of Christianity Today, titled Biblical Archaeology's Dusty Little Secret. If you have a question or a comment on the James Bonebox, give us a call in the next 10 minutes, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Gordon, one thing that's always fascinated me, and that is, and we also saw it with the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, there tends to be a bit of kind of finders keepers, or at least possession is 9/10 of the law at work with these artifacts. And there are people, scholars of repute, who don't want others to have access to these artifacts sometimes. How do you explain that?
Well, I guess basic human nature. There's a possessiveness that you can see in your children, and it doesn't completely disappear when you grow up and become a scientist and work on exciting discoveries in whatever field it is. And you're right, about 10, 12 years ago, this really came to a head related to the Dead Sea Scrolls, and finally they were freed from the hands of a small group of scholars, and now they're available to almost everybody, and they've almost been totally published at this point, after it had bogged down for about 4 decades. And now with the James ossuary, you have scientists in Israel who are a little bit possessive of it, and have sort of taken a stance that they know really what it's all about, even though the evidence may not necessarily back up. They've taken a political stand, and some people think that the findings that they've made are political and not totally scientific.
Who does the ossuary actually belong to? It was in the possession of a private collector, later arrested, alleged forger, or at least a facilitator of forgeries.
Absolutely. His name is Oded Golan. He's about my age, about 51 years old, and he is apparently one of the largest collectors, has one of the largest collections of antiquities in Israel, and he has still has ownership of it. I'm not exactly sure. I'm pretty sure it's still in his possession in his apartment in Tel Aviv. And in fact, the Israeli authorities took him into custody last summer and made a big announcement about how he was in big trouble, and they were really going to come down on him hard. But interestingly enough, no charges have been filed against him in relation to the ossuary, and it was almost as if they were trying to have him make their case for him, and so far he hasn't done that, and some people maintain then that he is innocent.
What possible reason would the Israeli Antiquities Organization have for, let's just say for the sake of argument, they want to call this into question. What possible reason would there be for them to call this ossuary into question?
Well, it's a pretty valid reason when you look at it from their standpoint. They have a major problem with looting in their country. People who are finding tombs. Maybe farmers out there, I don't want to say that they're all Palestinians, but it's a particular problem in the Palestinian areas where somebody would stumble across, say, a tomb or some remains that's 2,000 years old, and instead of reporting it to authorities so that scientists could properly evaluate and accumulate the knowledge that could be accumulated from that discovery, they just take it to a friend of theirs who is a dealer and knows who the antiquities dealers are and will sell it to them. And really, that's how the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. Some shepherds found some old scraps of leather, and according to the story, they thought, well, maybe we can, you know, make a bag out of this or make some shoes or something, and they took them to a cobbler in Bethlehem, and he happened to know that they were a little more valuable than that, and that's how the Dead Sea Scrolls surfaced.
So how would you describe the role of private collectors in this whole saga of biblical archaeology in the Holy Land?
Well, private collectors are not looked upon by archaeologists in a very positive light. But private collecting is legal in Israel. You can go to a store in Jerusalem and legally buy a 2,000 or 3,000-year-old artifact that supposedly came from some source that was not a tomb or something that somebody looted somewhere. But I think there's a lot of eye-winking and behind-the-scenes things that go on, and everybody knows this. So it's a trade that some people say archaeologists hate, but yet they can't live without it, because sometimes they find, if all of a sudden a bunch of artifacts comes on the market and they know that somebody's made a big discovery, and they go looking for it and hopefully find something before it's all gone.
We've talked about the ossuary before with others, and almost to a person, people from BAR with Dr. Paul Meyer of Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, and all of them to a man have said, look, even if this is authentic, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't, they're all hedging their bets, it doesn't really add anything to what we already know beyond the scriptural accounts. Is that the case?
Well, that's what I said earlier, and that's what a number of archaeologists told me. But Ben Witherington, who co-wrote the book with Herschel Shanks about the ossuary called The Brother of Jesus, came out several months ago, says that, well, it's a little more than that. What it does show, what it does remind us, is that the first century church came out of Judaism, and the first Christians were Jews. And James, if this really is his ossuary, was buried in a very traditional Jewish manner, as related to the Jewish life in the first century. And I think that's a good reminder.
Finally, is the determination of this ossuary's authenticity, you said before it would simply be impossible to prove at this point, is that not so much a factor of archaeology and determining the authenticity of the inscription, but also a factor of politics as well?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a political process. In essence, the people who believe it's authentic have to marshal the evidence as best they can to convince the other people, the other experts, the other people in our field that it is authentic. And in order to do that, you have to have some good scientific tests that have been done, and then you have to have that information, that evidence, and then people can discuss it. And basically a consensus develops. And at some point, it'll probably take a number of months yet, but consensus will develop that it is authentic or it is not. Right now, based upon the June news conference by the Israel Antiquities Authority, the feeling, the popular perception is that it is not authentic because the experts tested it and the experts said the inscription was a fraud. However, the experts have not revealed the evidence for that, and so it's very fair to say, hold on a minute, we'll just wait and see about this.
Gordon Govier, thank you for being our guest.
Todd, it's been my pleasure.
Gordon Govier is news director for WNWC Radio in Madison, Wisconsin, executive producer of a weekly radio program called The Book and the Spade, and author of the cover story in Christianity Today called Biblical Archaeology's Dusty Little Secret. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If the Book of Romans is Paul's treatise on justification by grace through faith, then the Book of Colossians is Paul's treatise on Christ. What does Paul teach in the book of Colossians on the person and work of Jesus Christ? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for September is the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Colossians by Dr. Paul Dieterding. The book costs $39.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order by calling Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go online at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the book. 1-800-325-3040, issuesetc.org. When you call or write, ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September.
Minute focuses prayer on Jewish families living in Argentina. An economic crunch means not all parents can afford to send their children to Hebrew school. Argentina's economic turmoil has impacted all citizens, including the country's Jewish population. Some families are relocating to Israel, while others are reporting a renewed passion among pockets of an Argentinian Jewish community. The circumstances and the desire to strengthen Jewish culture create barriers for sharing Christ the Messiah. But that's the work of a husband and wife team serving in Argentina under Gospel Missionary Union. One prayer request is that Stephen and Marianne Rivar will build strong relationships with their neighbors. Another prayer request is that Stephen will advance in his studies at the Hebrew Language Institute. Pray that Jewish families in Argentina will respond to Christ's love. Get updates on sharing Christ around the globe. Log on to www.gmu.org. That's gmu.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. I still remember the blazing hot sun and the squishy ground beneath my feet from the recent rain. It was 25 years ago when church members took their young pastor to the Farm Progress Show. Today, the 50th annual Farm Progress Show opens on 1,500 acres northwest of Danville, Illinois. There will be some 360 exhibitors, showing off the latest in farm equipment, the newest seeds, field techniques, computer programs, and, of course, a country music concert. Bring your checkbook, and you can buy a combine, a silo, or a milking parlor. Financing available on the spot. Most media isn't going to cover this, of course. We take for granted the miracle of American agriculture. For that matter, most of us take food for granted. How many of us are in the habit of saying grace before our meals? When TV shows us adults in underdeveloped countries scrambling for food, do we think that our national epidemic of obesity might reveal more than just a health problem? Oh, give thanks unto the Lord, for He is good, says Psalm 136. And let us help those whose table is bare.
Ever wonder what you can do with that painting from Aunt Sophie? Wonder no more. Donate those unused or overused art pieces to Lutheran Family and Children's Services of Missouri for its upcoming art market. It'll be held during LFCS's Family Walk Fall Festival on October 4th at Concordia Seminary. Bring your paintings, sculptures, decorative frames to the LFCS office located at Del Mar and I-170 between 8:30 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk a bit about this Bible zine, as they're calling it, the Revolve New Testament for Young Ladies. Dr. Russell Moore of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary will join us. He's had a few things to say about this new girl's Bible on MSNBC. Also, Church Conventions. Doug LeBlanc of Christianity Today magazine joins us tomorrow on Issues Etc. For the remainder of this first hour, Dr. David Menton joins us, Associate Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University, a speaker for Answers in Genesis, and President of the Missouri Association for Creation. The story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch is about a bone find and the questions that it raises about the course of human development and the ages of human development as well. Dr. Menton, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
What is this discovery, and what questions does it raise regarding popular presuppositions about the course of human development?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. I believe that there are three ways to make an ape man. One is to take what is clearly a ape or ape-like creature and upscale it to a human by trying to argue certain parts of the body are more human-like than we might expect of an ape. We've done that with Lucy, the scientific name Australopithecus afarensis. The other approach is to take what are clearly human skeletons in the fossil record and try to downscale them and make ape men out of them. And that has certainly been done with Neanderthal man. And the third approach is to take ape fossils from one location, human fossils from yet another, and combine the two together and declare them to be one individual. And I'm afraid that sort of thing has been done from time to time as well, most famously with Piltdown Man. But it's intriguing that the scientific community has gone back and forth on Neanderthal Man. One minute they're telling us it's just a human being with certain characteristics that allow us to single it out as Neanderthal Man, but still fully human. In other cases, they're trying to tell us that Neanderthal Man didn't even interbreed with humans, had nothing to do with humans. It's a totally separate creature, and it would appear that Dr. Trinkaus has declared what he's actually said before in the literature, and that is Neanderthal Man is is Homo sapiens. That is, you know, that is the genus and species of Neanderthal Man. He is classified as Homo sapiens. Modern man is classified as Homo sapiens. They are essentially the same.
Now, I was under the impression that it was the popular view that Neanderthal not only didn't have interaction with modern humans as they're classified in these ancient times, but that he didn't interbreed, and therefore you've really got an evolutionary dead end with Neanderthal. That's
correct. That's been a relatively recent interpretation of the evidence. But, you know, if we go back to 1978, Dr. Trinkaus, who is an expert on Neanderthal Man, wrote an article in Natural History, volume 87, page 10. And in this article he said, and I quote, "Detailed comparisons of Neanderthal skeletal remains with those of modern humans have shown that there is nothing in Neanderthal anatomy that conclusively indicates locomotor, manipulative, intellectual, or linguistic abilities inferior to those of modern humans." So in other words, here is a specimen that even to this day continues to be classified under the genus Homo, the species sapiens, the very same one that you and I are in, and which was described back in 1978 as having no anatomical detail that's inconsistent with modern locomotor, manipulative, intellectual, linguistic abilities. And we've tried to downscale Neanderthal Man to make an ape man out of him, and it just doesn't work. And so, you know, if you're going to get an ape man, you have to do it either by upscaling an ape to make a human out of it or downscaling a human to make an ape. And I'm afraid we've done the latter in the case of Neanderthal Man.
How is it in the interests of those scholars who say that Neanderthal is a evolutionary dead end to make that case?
Well, we need ape men. We've been telling everybody that there are living organisms that have occurred in prehistory, which is a kind of a confusion of terms to begin with, but that there are living organisms that have occurred in prehistory that were neither human nor ape, that they were somewhere in between, i.e. ape men. And we've tried very hard to find ape men, something like the famous Lucy, which you see in our Living World Museum at the zoo, depicts what looks like a human being with an ape head. I mean, the body looks virtually human. In fact, the specimen looked nothing like that at all, and my understanding is that our museum there at the zoo and the people at the zoo know full well that that body has nothing to do with Australopithecus afarensis. This is an ape. In fact, in many respects, it was primitive even by ape standards. And yet, because of the angle that occurs between the femur and the tibia at the knee, the relative size of the incisors and molars, the thickness of the enamel and the teeth, because of some reasons like this, it's declared to be a ape-like ancestor of man. And, in fact, the sort of angle that you see between the femur and the tibia can be seen in living apes today. It's not unique to Lucy. It really depends on whether an ape carries its weight over its feet more centrally or not. And orangutans and spider monkeys have such carrying angles, and no one suggests that they are evolving into humans. but we make a big thing out of it. In the case of Neanderthal man, we have something that's clearly human. In fact, if you go back and look at the history of Neanderthal man, it's kind of interesting. It was the first ape man to be discovered. It was discovered back in Darwin's day. And, of course, Darwin was very badly in need of transitional fossils that showed how one organism evolved into another. And so they really glommed onto a Neanderthal man, which was first found and named from the Neander Valley in Germany back in 1856. It's kind of interesting that the great Lutheran hymn writer, Joachim Neander, it's his family after which the Neanderthal Valley, after which Neanderthal man gets its name. And he wrote, among other things, that great hymn, Praise to the Lord, the King of Creation. But be that as it may, when the fossils were first found there, which involved a skull cap and a couple of femurs and two humeri and other fragments of the skeleton, they were looked at by a human anatomist at the time, Professor Schaffhausen, and he declared them to simply be human and normal. And then a couple years later, similar skulls were found in Belgium, and subsequently there have been like 60 or more, maybe close to 100 nowadays, of Neanderthal-type specimens that have been found throughout China, Central, North Africa, Iraq, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Greece, Northwestern Europe, all over the world. And there's absolutely nothing about these skeletons that would indicate that they're anything other than human. Now, there are distinctive features that allow us to conclude that they are a variety of human that we would call Neanderthal, just as there are distinctive features about a skeleton of, say, an Australian Aboriginal or an Eskimo or a Nordic individual. But there's nothing about them to suggest they were anything other than what we, in fact, classify them as being, Homo sapiens, i.e. us.
So in all the ways that a modern human skeleton, one can vary from another depending upon one's ancestry, Neanderthal does not fall outside the normal parameters of variables in the shape or the configuration of a normal human skeleton.
That's right. There's a combination of things which, when found, leads one to conclude, you know, these are so-called Neanderthal. For example, Neanderthal man had a somewhat receding jawline, as you see among some people today. The jaw, instead of being pointed and sticking out, was a little bit more receding, not outside the range of human variability. The upper jaw tends to be somewhat larger. In fact, the jaws themselves are quite large. These individuals had no trouble having their wisdom teeth, for example. Today, our jaws are a little shorter due to changes that have occurred over relatively recent history. And we oftentimes don't have room for our third molars. But Neanderthal man had plenty of room for his third molars and even had a retromolar space behind that. But you see similar things even in humans today. It's just that most people today would maybe have a little trouble having their third molars grow in normally. Another characteristic, Neanderthal man had a skull that was a little bit elongated front to back compared to most humans today. But I was just on a plane this weekend and happened to notice somebody sitting next to me that had a rather elongated skull front to back. It would be Neanderthal-like. It's interesting that if you look at the cranial capacity, you know, we put a lot of emphasis on, you know, big brain, really smart. Well, it turns out this is not really true. The size of the brain doesn't directly have anything to do with intelligence, although we can certainly say that human beings, on average, have a cranial capacity for their brain of about a liter and a half. But there are perfectly normal people that have, say, 800 cc's, 900 cc's, something in that range. And there are perfectly normal people who aren't exceptionally bright who are well over 2 liters in size. But evolutionists make a big thing out of brain size and cranial capacity, and it's interesting. They don't bring it up much in relationship to Neanderthal man because, on average, Neanderthal man had a brain that was 200 cc's larger than our brains today, on average. So, you know, we have seen Neanderthal men buried in conditions that clearly involve funeral customs. We have seen artifacts that Neanderthal has made In fact, most recently, there was a Neanderthal specimen buried in association with a flute that was made out of bone. The flute was essentially playable. It had holes on it that could be covered with the fingers. Neanderthal man had a culture. He engaged in certain medical procedures. Bones were set when they were fractured. This is a human being we're talking about here. And, of course, there are humans in the fossil record. But it just happens that Neanderthal man is, because he was found at a time when Darwin came up with his theory for which there was little or no fossil support, that there was an effort to glom on to these fossils as being primitive, because the evolutionary theory isn't really a theory, it's a paradigm or speculation, had anticipated there would be such beings.
We're talking with Dr. David Menton about a recent finding allegedly providing a link between Neanderthals and early Europeans. Dr. David Menton is Associate Professor of Anatomy, Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University. Dr. Menton, let's see if we can go back on the human timeline. Describe to us then what we are really observing in the fossil record when it comes to Neanderthal and the differences with modern human beings. I remember a show that was on about 5 years ago, the Discovery Channel or something like that, about Neanderthal man, how he was driven out of existence by the smarter, swifter, more resourceful modern human being when that species encroached upon his territory. What really happened? You've established these are bona fide human beings, modern people.
Very much like modern man. Now, they may have lived in caves or what have you. We have people today living in caves, right? I believe the Neanderthal man dates back to a period of time shortly after the flood. And yes, I do believe in Noah's flood, and I do believe that it covered the whole earth, even as the scriptures say, covering the highest mountains at the time. And with the runoff of that flood, the climate, I believe, had changed considerably. We had an ice age that lasted for probably 200, 400 years, something in that range, because of radical changes in the climate attending all of the events occurring at the time of the flood. And these individuals may date back to that period. They appear to have lived a pretty rough life. They were very, very muscular, robust people. They didn't look like a bunch of sedentary pencil pushers, I can tell you that. They were rugged-looking, muscular people. Some of them had osteodegenerative diseases that might have come from arthritic deformations have been observed even in some of the earliest specimens found. And these arthritic deformations are not greatly different than what we see in some humans today. And given the time they lived in, which I believe was that sort of post-flood period, they have left a few fossils in the fossil record, as indeed we do find human beings in the fossil record. But I believe that they were human beings, not greatly different from human beings who lived before the flood, except they reflect the particular genetic pool that this subset represents. You know, if people run off to a certain part of the country or get isolated, interbreed among one or another, you get certain genetic characteristics for that group of people. Even certain diseases become more common among those people. I believe Neanderthals were just simply a name we give to people who lived for some time after the flood, and there's nothing about their bodies that make them fundamentally different from anyone today, although I concede there are a set of characteristics which allow us to single out certain fossil specimens as being of a type we call Neanderthal. They had a little bit longer distance between their pubic bones and their sacrum, that anterior posterior direction in the pelvis. Again, not outside the range of modern humans today, but certainly consistently longer than we see in the average modern human today. And as for the dates that have been assessed, like 35,000 years in the case of the jawbone that Dr. Trinkaus found, this is based on radiocarbon dating, which is kind of interesting because you wouldn't be able to do radiocarbon dating were it not for the fact that this specimen still contained a lot of organic material, because you can't date something by radiocarbon unless it contains carbon. And most rocks, certainly sedimentary-type rocks, don't contain carbon. Most fossils are completely replaced by mineral, and so you wouldn't find carbon. The fact that they were able to do carbon dating on the specimen indicates that this jaw had a fair amount of organic material left in it, probably looking pretty much like a bone you'd find from some cow that died 10, 12 years ago, kind of a lightweight, still very organic bone. And radiocarbon dating cannot be used to date anything over 200,000 years in age because of the short half-life of this material. And when you look at radiocarbon dating, you find all sorts of, you know, obvious errors. We find burned wood, for example, in rocks that should be millions of years old. You date it because the wood is dateable, and the wood turns out to be a few thousand years old. So the dating methods are really not reliable. I don't accept these dates as being the last word on the date of this specimen. I believe man has been on Earth for something in the range of 6,000 years, and that reflects the age of our Earth. Now, some people hearing this may be rather outraged, thinking that radiometric dating has proven something different. But it turns out there are many, many different ways to date the Earth. You can date it by the amount of salt that's accumulating in the ocean. You can date it at the rate that sediment is accumulating in the bottom of the ocean. You can date it by the rate at which helium is outgassing from the Earth. And all of these methods give different dates, mostly much younger than the kind of dates we get out of some of the radiometric dates, like the potassium-argon methods and what have you. But all of these dating methods involve a long series of assumptions, and if the assumptions aren't true, the dating methods are not true.
Can we take something today, the wood from the table in front of me?
Mm-hmm.
Can we subject it to radiocarbon dating and get an accurate reading there?
Presumably, anything that contains, you know, natural carbon could theoretically be dated by radiocarbon methods. I interject that virtually nothing of evolutionary significance could be dated by radiocarbon methods, since real evolution that evolutionists talk about, which I happen not to accept, would take place over a matter of hundreds of thousands and certainly millions of years. And radiocarbon has absolutely no ability to measure things in that range. The half-life of radiocarbon we can round off to, say, roughly 6,000 years. So every 6,000 years you have half of the amount of the material you started with. Well, how many times can you half it until you really don't have much to measure anymore and your error just goes into the stratosphere? I don't know of anybody who would trust radiocarbon methods more than, say, 200,000 years. But the question is, you can date things that whose dates are knowable, wood from castles and what have you, where we have independent methods of determining the date, and we find that the earlier the dates, the greater the error. And the fact that we can get radiocarbon measurements of things which by other means are believed to be millions of years old, and yet we measure thousands in radiocarbon from, say, woody specimens, embedded in rock believed to be millions of years old, shows that there's something really dreadfully wrong with our dating methods. And so I happen not to accept these dates, and I find a lot of people who accept the dates do so rather uncritically and really don't understand the dating methods anyway.
If Trinkaus is correct, and what he that these specimens that have been found may represent the interbreeding between so-called modern humans and Neanderthal, then it would be reasonable to conclude that people are living today with so-called Neanderthal DNA, if you're going to be consistent.
Absolutely, and I would agree. I mean, I think what Dr. Trinkaus is saying here is, in the essence of it all, quite true, and it's what he's been saying all along, and that is, lighten up. Neanderthals are not significantly different from what we would call just modern human beings today. And they would have interbred just as surely as an Australian Aboriginal could interbreed with whatever other variety of human you have in mind. There's nothing intrinsically inferior, of course, about an Australian Aboriginal or a Neanderthal. They simply show a range of skeletal characteristics which allow us to categorize them. But, you know, we no longer speak of humans as being different races. This is true of the scientific community in general. We now know that all human beings differ from one another by less than 0.2% of all of their genes. That includes the difference between a male and a female. And so we no longer consider them to be any more than simply one race of human beings, and that race is Homo sapiens. And I'm sure the same thing would be essentially true with Neanderthal man. It's a human being. And, you know, this is a Christian radio station, so let's comment in this area. If we have people out there who are Homo sapiens but not really humans, who never interbred with humans, what does this tell us about the redemptive work of Jesus Christ and the cross to save man from sin, death, and the power of the devil? Does this apply to Neanderthal man? Are we to consider Neanderthal man as to be some sort of soulless human being? I think we get into a lot of spiritually and theologically questionable areas when we touch on this. I think it's safer to recognize, as indeed the scientific community is beginning to do, that all human beings are really one group of people who really don't differ that much. We all have one ancestor, that is Adam and Eve, by way of Noah, and we all share much more in common than we are different. And while, yes, there may be some consistent differences in the skeleton of people who live in one part of the world versus those who live in another, these differences are really very trivial.
With only 1 minute left, why the Neanderthal myth was created at Darwin's time, why does it persist today in spite of the testimony of scientists like Trinkaus?
Well, now, of course, Dr. Trinkaus would certainly accept the evolutionary view, which, you know, I would not. He's merely arguing that what we would call modern humans and these Neanderthals interbred. But I think the whole issue is that much of the scientific community has such a commitment to evolution. And, of course, the most interesting kind of evolution is the evolution of man from non-human ancestors, that they're working very hard to find an ancestor. And so in the case of Neanderthal man, we've taken what is classified, and I repeat again, and I'm getting tedious on this, I know, but it's classified as Homo sapiens. And are we to believe that Homo sapiens interbred with Homo sapiens? I should think so. Are we to believe that Homo sapiens today may have Homo sapiens ancestry? I would hope so.
30 seconds.
And it's really as simple as that. Neanderthal man is Homo sapiens. And are we related? Well, are we related to Homo sapiens? I mean, that's, you know, almost a silly question. Of course. It just happens that people who have these particular skeletal characteristics appear not to be represented among the varieties of humans that we have on Earth today. At least not with a consistent combination of characteristics, but any one of the characteristics can be found in living humans.
Dr. David Menton, thank you very much for being our guest and for shedding light on this sometimes confusing subject.
Thank you.
Dr. David Menton is Associate Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University. He's Speaker for Answers in Genesis and President of the Missouri Association for Creation. When we come back, I'll tell you about their website, and we'll talk with Bob Leko.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.